Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Autism Stories. I'm your host, Doug Bletcher, the founder of Autism Personal Coach. Autistic people are the true experts of the autistic experience, and Autism Stories is where we interview autistic people to learn from their stories, experiences, and get their insights. If you would like to be notified about each week's episode of Autism Stories, we suggest you subscribe on your favorite podcast listening platform. We would also appreciate it if you could give us a positive rating and review, as it will help others to learn about Autism Stories. On today's episode, Chris Jarrell joins me to discuss being a practicing Buddhist and research for his new book on autism, meditation, and mindfulness. We hope you enjoy today's conversation. Chris, thanks so much for joining me today.
Hi, it's nice to be here, Doug.
And I'd like for us to begin our, what I think is going to be a wonderful conversation, by learning about where does your story in the autistic community begin?
Yeah, I guess community is the operative word there, because obviously autism is a lifelong condition, but I wasn't aware I was autistic until very late on. I mean, I'm in my late 60s now. It starts really with occupational burnout in my late 50s, early 60s at work in a university, and deepening depression, anxiety, eventually just crashing out. Long story short, that led to a very late autism diagnosis. But in terms of community, after my diagnosis, I was pretty well left without any post-diagnostic backup. They just kind of gave me the diagnosis and that was it. Certainly no specialist autistic backup. So I had to find my own way. So I did what most people seem to do, which is started reading. And also talking to my sister, actually, who is ADHD, because I'm from a neurodiverse family, most of whom don't know that they're neurodiverse, but that's another story. But my sister's diagnosed ADHD. She's 5 years younger than me, so able to talk to her, but still feeling kind of isolated. So I started writing. I'd always wanted to write. When I retired, that was my opportunity. And they always say, if you've got lemons, make lemonade. So I started writing about autism. So I started having conversations with autistic people on Zoom. And that's really when I started really just even becoming aware that there is an autistic community. And that kind of led on to other opportunities. I mean, one really lovely one is on a Tuesday morning, I help run a chess club in the neighborhood for home educated children, which I didn't realize when I started it up with a friend. Many of them are autistic. Many home educated children are autistic, and some of the parents are as well. So I get a chance to meet face to face on a Tuesday morning. But I'm also part of a small online autistic sangha, a spiritual community and Buddhist community that we meet once a fortnight for an hour on a Sunday. And just recently, for various reasons, I've started seeing an autistic counsellor, which is a breath of fresh air, really, to talk to a counsellor who's autistic. So, yeah, I do feel... there's times on a day-to-day basis I do feel quite isolated, but when I look at it overall, I do feel like I'm part of a community now.
Meditation is something that's a part of my daily practice. So I'm excited to talk to you because you're researching a new book on autism, meditation, and mindfulness, with the working title being Of Quieting the Mind. So I'm wondering, what's your experience with meditation?
Sure. Just very quickly tell you a funny story about this, because when you emailed me, you said the working title for the book is called Quieting the Mind. And I thought, no, it's not. It's Quietening the Mind. And then I did a quick Google search and I realized that, you know, you Americans say quieting and us English say quietening. But I thought I'd actually got it wrong for a minute, and a little bit of a panic there. I try and meditate 20 minutes a day, although that's not always possible to sit down formally and meditate. But even if I can't sit down formally for 20 minutes, at some point during the day, I try and have a 20-minute quiet spot, quiet my mind. And basically, what I do is very simply putting my attention on my breath as I breathe in and out, because meditation is very much about focus, single focus in amongst a sort of very busy mind. As I follow my breath, so as I'm breathing in and breathing out, I just notice that I'm breathing in and out. But also, as I begin to focus, I can notice more easily what I'm thinking and feeling, because we don't always do that when we're rushing around. Or thoughts and feelings feel quite intrusive, can feel quite intrusive. So it's just a 20-minute slot where you can sit down and, take more notice of what I'm thinking and feeling, and but also trying not to get too attached to what I'm thinking and feeling. Just kind of, I always liken it to, if you're sat watching clouds in the sky as they drift by, if a thought comes into your mind, just sort of watch it drift by, or a feeling. It's not always, I'm making it sound simple. It's not that simple when you first start. And sometimes thoughts and feelings can be quite intrusive and distressing, and it's not easy to just sit and watch them and not get too attached to them. But that's the basic principle. You just say hi to them and then let go, as the because they don't last that long, comparatively speaking. And I find it helps me to feel calmer and clearer. I've been meditating for many years, and it's not a quick fix. It's a skill that you need to learn, and I'm still learning, very much so learning. And there's lots of obstacles that I've had to overcome on the way, and I still deal with on a daily basis, like, just simply like getting bored or feeling very restless or getting distracted. But I just try and return to observing my breath and, smiling at the world if I can.
There are some days where I'm just feeling more overwhelmed than others, and I think about meditation as that part of my schedule, part of my routine. And I think, oh, I do not want to do this at all. But then I think back to like, oh, well, I might feel 1%, or I know I'm going to feel at least 1% or 5% better when I do meditate. Is it something that's it's easy for you to just do every day, or are there some days like you feel like I really don't want to do this?
There are days when I feel like I don't want to do it, but what I've learned is that if I approach it as a strict routine thing, then that's counterproductive. And so what I do is, if I choose not to meditate one day, I just try and find a quiet moment during the day. I might be sitting at a red light in the car, or I might be walking across the park, or standing in line at the post office like I was this morning. And just start gently following the breath and just reminding myself that meditation is part of my life. But I think certainly when people, I mean, I know you've been meditating for a while, Doug, and I'm not suggesting this is the case with you, but certainly when people start to meditate, particularly autistic people, because we don't do things by halves, if we do something, we do it, and it becomes all consuming.
For sure.
And it's so easy to give yourself a hard time about not doing it, but that's counterproductive in my experience.
Part of your book is about mindfulness, and mindfulness, I think, can mean many different things to many different people. When you think about the concept of mindfulness, what does it mean to you?
Well, it does mean many different things to many different people, and my take on mindfulness is from a Buddhist perspective. And I've been giving this some thought, and as you'd expect, because I'm editing a book on it, but I just came up with something that keeps coming back to me that I read somewhere, is that mindfulness is simply a gentle and accepting awareness. It's a quality of mind rather than a tangible thing. And it's just gently accepting what we are thinking and feeling, and what we can see and hear around us. This is in contrast to meditation, which is where we focus on a single point, either our breath or a mantra. But mindfulness is more of a general awareness. But the quality of the awareness is it's non-judgmental and more accepting. You know, as well as I do, and as I'm sure listeners will, that most of the time we think we should do this, or we're good at this, or we're bad at that, or we could do better. And I think as autistic people living in a neurotypical world, that's amplified for us, that kind of judging ourselves. But being mindful of that kind of thinking is just like not taking that to heart and just, well, okay, that's part of my experience. I do think these things, I do feel these things, but it doesn't necessarily make it right or wrong. And it's just part of that journey towards being more accepting and dealing with some of that negativity in our lives. Yeah, to a simple awareness and acceptance can, I think, over a period of time, bring peace of mind. But I'm not suggesting it's that simple. I mean, my experience as an autistic person is very up and down, and good days and bad days. Yeah, but some people call mindfulness, from a Buddhist perspective, ordinary magic, and it certainly can have that effect sometimes.
When you're talking about gentle and accepting awareness, I think that makes me think about when we learn about our autistic identity. So I'm wondering, how do you think that your autistic identity impacts you regarding meditation?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And this is what I'm hoping to explore more in the book that I'm editing. And at some point in the near future, I'll be reaching out to, well, in fact, this podcast is very much part of, not all about reaching out, but partly reaching out to other autistic folk that meditate and practice mindfulness so that I can understand it better from other people's perspectives. But from my perspective, I mean, I have a very overactive mind. I think a lot, and I think very deeply, too deeply, some might say. Other people might see that as a strength. And I tend to hang on to feelings and experiences. I have very strong memory recall. And I know that both of those things are autistic tendencies. But these two, what could be perceived as positive qualities, can also be an obstacle and a distraction to meditation, because there's more traffic to deal with when I'm sat following my breath. You know, those trucks and cars and buses are coming through one after another, and there's a lot of diesel fumes flying around. And on bad days, on good days, there's some clarity, some spaces, and some clear air. So that's definitely, I think, a way that autism can impact on meditation. But meditation is a skill, as I said earlier, that can be learned. And I think because I've been doing it for so long now, you know, my mind has become quieter. I think I can say that I have more perspective on my feelings, a better understanding, although, like anybody else, I can get caught up in the moment because things sneak upon us. And before we know it, we're having strong feelings like anger or anxiety. And it's like, however much you meditate or however mindful you are, if it's going to get you, if it's going to get you, you know, we've got to be real about this. So that's one aspect. And the other one that I came up with was, as I referred to earlier, judging myself as being a bad neurotypical person. And for years, decades even, I thought, you know, I was a bad neurotypical person. It was as simple as that. And mindfulness does help me to accept myself as an autistic person, because it helps me to value my strengths. And it also helps me to be kinder to other people in a roundabout way, because I'm less edgy and defensive about being myself. I'm trying to think of an example, but I can't. But I hope people get the gist of what I'm trying to say there. I'd like to hear examples of other people's experiences of both of those and other things, perhaps, that, you know, I've yet to hear about. I'm on a steep learning curve about this.
And if there are autistic people listening to this interview that are interested in talking to you, how can they go about contacting you?
Yeah, I can give my email address out. Shall I do that now, or shall I?
Sure.
Yeah. Well, my name is Gerald. So if I spell that to you first, because that's the bulk of my email address. So it's JARRELL. Actually, that's a good old West Virginia name. My folk are from West Virginia. And if you go to certain parts of southern West Virginia, there's whole townships full of Jarls. So, but that's another story. My email address is jarl@jarl.caru, which is KARRO.co.uk. And then we can set up a Zoom. We can communicate however you want to. We can do Zoom with video or Zoom without video. We can do email. We could even talk via WhatsApp on the phone. You choose how you want to communicate. If you don't use speech or language and you simply want to write to me, that's absolutely fine. I'd love to hear from you.
And you've been a practicing Buddhist, I believe, for over 30 years, and have recently edited a book on autism and Buddhist practice. What might be ways that Buddhism can help autistics create well-being in our lives?
Sure. Autism and Buddhist practice, if I can just put a plug in there, Doug, is published by Jessica Kingsley Publishers, who specialize in publishing books about autism and by autistic people, as well as other subjects. And that was published in December of last year, so fairly recent publication. And hot off the press, I got an email from my local library today to say they're going to buy a copy and put it on the shelf. So I'm really pleased about that. So Buddhism and well-being in autistic people, I tend to sort of use as a starting point those three criteria, if you like, of sensory overload and social communication difficulties and special interests. I mean, I know we're all different, but it seems that those are the three things that keep cropping up as, things that we have difficulty with, and sort of general headings. The really nice thing about Buddhism, which only occurred to me actually very recently, was that it's so accepting of being solitary and being alone and being quiet and renunciation and finding quiet spaces, because that's part of the crucial practice of Buddhism, that you need to find that time to reflect. And that suits us down to a T. And it also actually sort of makes sense of why I've spent a lot of my life seeking out those quiet spaces. So even when Buddhists come together as a group, there are still opportunities to be quiet and alone. Of course, there's a lot of chanting goes on with some groups as well, but I tend to stay away from groups like that. But Buddhism gives me a psychological framework. Buddhist psychology is very logical and fairly simple to understand. I mean, I think a lot of people make it quite complicated, but there is a basic psychology in Buddhism. And the more I simplify it in my own mind, the more sense it makes of my autistic personality. It helps me with a way of understanding relationships, and it gives me an ethical roadmap. I'm not going to go into detail now. I mean, you'd have to buy the book, folks, to find out more about that. But more seriously, it just appeals to me as an autistic person, and it also values what some people might see as autistic qualities like loyalty, perseverance, ethical ways of living. That's not exclusive to Buddhism. I'm not claiming that for Buddhism, but Buddhism does make that very clear that those are important aspects of being in community with other people. But I'm sure other religions, although strictly speaking, Buddhism isn't a religion, but certainly religions could equally say that that's part of their fundamental template. And also in a similar vein, there is a supportive community of spiritual practitioners and friends available in Buddhism. And in terms of being isolated in society generally, I think such a welcoming and accepting community is a way of us finding our way into community as autistic people. Having said that, some of the book does talk about some of the difficulties that we have being accepted as autistic neurotypical Buddhist communities, but that's a work in progress. So I hope that goes some way to answer. And the final part of that is Buddhism is based on the practice of meditation and mindfulness, which is central to my life these days, has become more central. Think about, just very quickly, think about Buddhism is there are lots of different schools and traditions. So if anybody is thinking of checking it out, one of the things you just need to be careful about is that there are different entry points into Buddhism, and they're often advertised as a book or a study day or a meditation workshop. And they don't necessarily say that we are of the such and such tradition or school. And it's not until you get further in that you realize that you're going down a particular road. So it's worth checking out what the different schools and traditions are. And then when you see a workshop advertised, meditation workshop, you can always ask that question up front and see what kind of answer you get. Because different schools and traditions are suited to different people. History, this is simply about, you could get into one school of tradition and it doesn't work for you, whereas if you'd gone in another direction, you could have had a much better outcome.
I wanted to ask you about self-publishing, as you've self-published a historical novel last year titled The Ballad of Fenton Wells that's currently in Barnes and Noble, among other places. So I'm wondering what advice you might have to other writers, other autistic writers who might be interested in self-publishing but aren't quite sure where to start. Was it an easy process to get into Barnes and Noble or Amazon, or was that a difficult journey?
It was difficult in that it was completely new to me, but with most things, with hindsight, when you look back, it perhaps wasn't as difficult as I thought at the time. But that's partly about me not being a tech person. So it took me a long time to understand some of the twists and turns of the tech process. But just to take a step back from that aspect, I did just want to say that one of the things about self-publishing is I think there's some really, really good self-published material out there now. And self-publishing used to be thought of as vanity publishing, but it just isn't like that these days because publishing market I sound like I'm an expert, don't I? But I'm not. I'm just talking based on my recent experience. What I've learned is the publishing market is just so crowded, so cutthroat, that there are some really good quality manuscripts being rejected by publishers that perhaps once would have been accepted and taken on board. So the fact that you're thinking of self-publishing shouldn't be seen as a second-rate option. And in fact, many people choose to self-publish now because, the publisher always has a perspective on what you've written and I've been lucky. My publisher was very accommodating and willing to listen to me, but I hear that other publishers can be a bit more dogmatic in what they're expecting people to change in their manuscripts. But so it's a good thing to self-publish, and don't forget, no, don't skimp on the quality of the manuscript. Make sure that you develop your writing skills so that when you get ready to self-publish, you're confident that you've got a good product there. Maybe work with a copy editor or a proofreader. Who could be a friend? They don't have to be professionals. Just get that third eye perspective on what you're writing. Don't keep your baby close to yourself and then suddenly launch it on the world, because that's going to be problematic, I'm sure. Anyway, then you can either pay for publishing support. There's lots of companies online that for a fee will publish your manuscripts. Take it through the publishing process, etc., like proofreading, copy editing, and marketing, a certain amount of marketing. Or you can use which goes, I think, directly to your question, though. You can use an online platform. I used a draft to digital. I know there's a big difference in pronunciation here between America and the UK, so it's more like draft. draft to digital. When I'm in West Virginia and I ask for a glass of water, they say, "Water? What's water?" And my cousin nudges me and says, "It's not water, it's water." So now I just sit in the restaurant and say, and they say, "What do you want?" I say, "I want water." And they, "No problem." So it's draft to digital, but I would say draft to digital. And it's draft, the figure two, draft, the figure two, digital. So if you look that up, that's an example. And you can upload your manuscript and they take it from there, but they take you through various checks. There's various things that you have to do, which I can't think of off the top of my head. And that and then eventually it ends up on Amazon and in Barnes and Noble and loads of other places. I mean, I haven't sold many of the Ballad of Fenton Wells because I haven't put the effort into marketing it. Very briefly, it's my grandparents' story in southern West Virginia, the first half of the 20th century, and it's based on a community, in the coal mining community in southern West Virginia. And I really wrote it with that community in mind, and that community has embraced the book, which is a result for me, because I wanted my grandparents' story to be witnessed. It's similar to many stories of families during that period. So I haven't pushed it marketing-wise, also because I'm not a social media person. But I think if you self-publish, you do need to be prepared to market through social media. And if you're not happy with that, hook up with somebody that can do that for you. And then the last thing I'd say on that is like everybody has a story to tell, so why not tell yours? But do remember it's a crowded market. So you need to think about what makes your story different and what its unique selling point might be. But yeah, go for it. Get that story written down. Press that button on the
Press the send button.
Press the send button. That's it. Yeah.
Well, Chris, I really enjoyed our conversation today. Thanks so much for making the time to talk with me.
I've enjoyed it, and thank you very much for inviting me to join you today.
Thanks so much to Chris for the conversation. To learn more about Chris, please check out the link in the podcast description for this episode. Here at Autism Personal Coach, our clients are the experts, our coaches are the guides. The majority of supports for autistics are not helpful. They try to fix us, not support us. That's why many are confused when we say our clients are the experts, experts of their lived experience. Our clients are experts for what has worked for them and about the things that they need and want in their lives. Our coaches first listen to our clients, then ask thoughtful questions, offer resources, and strategize with our clients so they can get what they need to thrive. Would you want a guide in your life to coach you to get the things you desire? If so, then visit autismpersonalcoach.com for more information. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Autism Stories, and if you did, if you could tell a friend, foe, or anyone you know about it so they could have the same enjoyable and educational experience as you when listening to Autism Stories, it would be very much appreciated. Until next time, I'm Doug Bletcher of Autism Personal Coach. Talk to you then.